Welcome to Intelligent Edge Yoga, yoga conversations for smart, compassionate practice with Catherine Ann Flynn. I'm Catherine. Hi, yogis. Today, I started another round of 200-hour teacher training at the wonderful Hamsa Yoga in Carlton Place. And one of the things we always begin with are sun salutations. Now, if you know me as a teacher, this is a little unusual because I do not teach sun salutations really all that frequently in class. But it's always worth exploring how things have been done to see where we are coming from and how it has shaped where we are going. Sun salutations have a wonderful mythological background. They begin with the story of Hanuman, who before he was involved in the love story of Rama and Sita, was a powerful or gifted with powers monkey-faced god. And Hanuman had a voracious appetite, and he saw the sun, and he confused it for a ripe, juicy mango, and he leapt at the sun, and he enveloped it in his mouth, and the world went into darkness. Now the sun, Surya, is actually a god, and he did not take kindly to be enveloped by a baby monkey, and the goddess Indra broke Hanuman's jaw to get him to release Surya. And feeling badly for this, she gifted him with powers. Now, later on in his life, his mother decided that it was time for him to be a pupil. And so she approached Surya and said, "If you have forgiven my son for trying to eat you earlier in life, would you consider taking him on as a pupil?" And Surya said, "Trying to eat me aside, I am far too busy and I move far too quickly to take on any kind of tutelage." However, Hanuman said, "I can move with you. I am fast enough. I can keep up with you." And so he moved with Surya through his studies, and it is said that he moved backward in front of Surya to keep up with him. And if you think of the sun salutation, you can think of that rhythm, the upward reach, the downward fold, the halfway lift, the stepping back and sliding down, and then sliding up and back to downward facing dog. Now, ultimately, he tried to repay Surya for learning from him. And Surya said, "There is no payment necessary." And Hanuman said, "Well, you have my salutations, right? You have the effort of my presence, the effortful revolution through this cycle." So that's why we call them Surya Namaskar, sun salutation. What we see from this story is that sometimes our biggest mistakes can be our biggest teachers. Now, you probably haven't wrapped your mouth around one of your teachers recently, or at least I hope you haven't, but you may in your past have eaten a grilled cheese sandwich. I asked my current teacher training this, "How does one make a grilled cheese sandwich?" Everyone was gamefully obliging and went through the steps. You would butter both sides of the bread. You would put cheese in between and then fry it. And I wanted to clarify what kind of cheese, the processed stuff that you unwrap from the plastic, et cetera, et cetera. Now there's a bakery in Toronto that I just love, and it's got the most delicious bread and the most delicious sandwiches. And I learned there that you should actually butter the outside of the bread with mayonnaise and butter. And that's what gets you a really even coat of fat on the bread. And it makes it really golden. And then they elevate it with, you know, all kinds of fancy cheeses. And it can be simple or with bacon, et cetera, et cetera. And always served with artisanal ketchup. This is not an unfamiliar thing in the food world. Many years ago, chefs started taking familiar comfort foods that would never have historically made it onto restaurant lists and started adding lobster to macaroni and cheese, or charging $35 for a hamburger because the meat was of an exceptional quality. Now, this is not a particularly unique approach to things. There was a restaurant in Montreal called Joe Beef, and they became famous for their version of the Kentucky Fried Chicken Double Down, which my understanding of which is deep fried meat as the bun with, I think, more meat on the inside. And Joe Beef did a version where it was foie gras forming both the, anyway, you get it. But they took something that you thought you knew, you thought was mundane, and then changed it enough to get you to consider how the components could be updated or evolved, but without really changing the central concept of the thing. Sun salutations present us with a real challenge as teachers and practitioners, because your mind is developed to pay less attention to things it thinks it knows. Now, yes, there are wonderful opportunities with things that we are familiar with because there is a flow quality to it. There can be a certain level of synchronicity. However, I would argue that for that synchronicity to truly be there, there needs to be a certain level of integration from all the practitioners. And that's a rare opportunity in your average modern drop-in yoga class. And that's not a bad thing. I love the diversity of my classrooms. It's just a reality. So we don't always have the synchronicity. And as Charles Duhigg talks about in The Power of Habit, your mental energy creates these neural pathways to help you save mental energy in the future. I might have talked about this in a past episode, but my students forgive me for some of my repetitiveness. So if you've already heard this, scroll ahead half a minute. Charles gives the example of backing out of the driveway. The first time you back out of the driveway, you have to check the mirror, put on the signal, put the car in reverse. The familiarity between the brake pedal and the gas pedal are not there yet. And so you might forget your lunch on the counter because you're having to invest so much mental energy in simply getting the car out of the driveway. Now, if you've driven for a long time, you understand so well that those movements, as minute as they are, the flickers of the eyes, the slight shift of the pedals, you do it almost unconsciously. And you might remember, oh, I forgot my lunch on the counter. You're designed this way to save you energy. But how that translates onto the yoga mat is not necessarily a good thing. Rapport and familiarity can be good things as long as we have teachers, as well as obviously internal dialogues, that are trying to heighten our awareness to the content and the practice at hand. Because the moment you feel you know something, the less attention you pay to it, the more you are being seduced by that internal monologue of, here's what I should have said to her. And you know what? I am going to eat that cookie later on. Oh, I can't wait for that cookie. Maybe you can tell where my priorities lie. This is, of course, a challenge if we change things up as well. Because if you put students in a solid foundation and then move them within that foundation, which I think is a really terrific way to integrate mobility-based strengthening into your classes without those tricky transitions that people have a difficult time navigating, after a couple of repetitions, they may pay less attention. The benefit you've got is that rather than the postural flow between poses of the sun salutations, they're in the same place doing the same thing. So say you're doing repetitions of a back strength based cobra, you could say, you know, shrug your shoulder heads back, peel your shoulders, neck, and then head up off the ground and lower back to the mat. Continue to do this. As you only lightly press into your hands, draw your upper arm bones back and your ribs forward. Try to leave your head down for as long as you can so you pick it up last. You may almost envision this as your chin hanging towards your chest before it lifts up. The repetition of the activity gives you, as a facilitator, the space to help them refine the movement. And as a practitioner, it gives us the opportunity to refine the movement. Not to mention that sometimes yoga teachers do not get the memo about reps. It's good to do something multiple times, take a break from it, and come back to it. Now, something my students noticed today that I have to admit I was a little surprised that they noticed was that I do not cue breath to movement in my asana sequences. There are occasionally an inhale, reach your arms up, but frankly, quite rarely. And that's for a couple of reasons. One of the reasons is that your breathing apparatus, the musculature that expands and contracts your lungs, is like any other muscle in your body, in that without work, it will grow limited in its ability. And it's only with consistent effort over time that its pliability and strength increases. There are people who practice with me who have practiced for twice or three times as long as I have. Some of them have incredible lung capacity. And there's always the guy who found out that yoga might help his golf game, and he's going to swing by for a month or maybe a couple of classes before we never see him again. You have to somehow split the difference. In most classes, you will be teaching to the average, and you are offering additional support for the beginners to help them feel as little confused as possible. And you are throwing in some opportunities for the quote unquote more experienced or advanced practitioners to explore their practice in a way that still honors the community, but they are not totally encumbered by a beginner experience. How could they possibly all breathe at the same rate? What ends up happening is you end up prescribing the length of the breath cycle. And in my opinion, people need to learn how to lengthen and increase their lung capacity, as well as increase their ability to move toward emptiness and hold emptiness with them, rather than simply sighing or panting for breath. So I do not cue breath match to movement. I do lots of breathing cues, but they're around the specifics of breathing or gentle reminders to come back to whatever it is that I focused on that day with the breath. I have been told that it creates an atmosphere of low anxiety, and people do not feel like they're hyperventilating, but rather they do have permission to explore that breath cycle. And I also feel that it just stops clogging the airwaves. There are so many things that I want to share, and I also recognize the power of less being said and allowing people to be in their practice with their breath and the sound of other people moving. Now, how to elevate that thing we think we know? The sun salutation has many different iterations on it, and it's got a fascinating history, of which I will link some from the show notes, including scholars who claim it was heavily influenced by British colonialism, and that, like much of asana, it may be the youngest part of yoga. It may have ancient roots, and we are not entirely sure when those roots of movement or martial arts influenced exercise married or yoked to yoga as a philosophical system. What I will say as a gentle reminder is that philosophies and religions arise to the needs of their time. And so yoga as a system probably did not need the strong, visceral experience of yoga asana when life was significantly more visceral. Our lives are increasingly cerebral. And I love what Sir Ken Robinson said in his TED talk, that scholars view their bodies as transportation for their heads. And in that way, we are all scholars. Our bodies move the things that look at the screen around. Anyway, we need the visceral components of practice, for we are imbalanced in our bodies. And so to invite harmony and balance into our body and thus cultivate in our mind, we need to move around. The sun salutation is familiar. And certainly if you're a new yoga teacher or you are a new practitioner, the level of familiarity can be comforting. However, as my teacher trainees saw with our posture clinic today, they don't know what they don't know in their ranges of movement. I saw a number of things that were entirely fixable if you know what you're looking for, or if you're willing to invest the time and effort to tidy things up now and then input the effort over a long period of time to see the change. But as we all know, the golf game guy may well not do that. The sun salutation is an economical way in your yoga class to move people around. That's really what we're trying to do. And it goes in certainly multiple directions, forward and back, that sliding backwards I referenced with the Hanuman story. But it's lacking a lot of diversity in terms of what's going on with the shoulders and the hips and knees and ankles. There's no twisting in it, etc. So it's certainly not enough to comprise an entire practice in and of itself. Some of the trickier parts are right at the heart of the sequence. When people step back into a plank position, they put their wrists at risk because our wrists bear the brunt of weak core strength. People lean into their foundation, as I talked about in the first episode of this podcast. People need to protect their wrists, but also develop strength through the arms and the core to lift their foundation off their hands. In the same way that you can sit cross-legged and slouch into the posture and lean into your low back, you can also effortfully lift up out of the foundation. And that's what we are looking to do with the plank posture. My cues around this encourage people to curl their fingertips into the ground and then do the perimeter of your palm. So on the palm, under your knuckles, around the palm, down toward the heel of the hand. And then slightly lift the hollow of your palm. You may find that your hands are more engaged. Sometimes I encourage people to feel like they are trying to open jars in opposite directions. You could also say, feel like you are trying to press your hands apart with a slight turn in opposite directions. Your hands will not move, but you will feel the difference. And we want to take that engagement and put it all the way up the arm into the shoulder. You can also try this with a wall. Go stand in front of a wall and set up what is essentially a plank position, and then go through that activity. Put your palms on the wall, curl your fingertips in, press around the perimeter of your palm into the wall, hollow out the palm, and then put that little turn away from one another into your hands. And if you can't feel what's happening, Take one hand off the wall and reach underneath your own armpit to hold on to your back. And if you can engage appropriately all the way up the arm, you'll feel your upper arm bone hug a little closer to your body, and you'll feel some of the musculature behind and under your shoulder engage. And this is going to help you keep your arms close to your body as you come to the mat. Now, what ends up happening is a lot of teachers just cue, keep your elbows close to the body. And I can tell you what that looks like. People hunch their elbows close to their body, and then either their bum comes down first and their chest eventually flops down, or vice versa. Their bum sort of hikes up and they cave through the shoulders and then come way too close to the ground if they're doing chaturanga, although that's a conversation for 2 minutes from now. Also, there is nothing wrong with stepping the hands a little wider. You could even step your feet a little wider and slowly come to the ground that way. And this is where we need to have the conversation. Why are we doing this? What is the purpose? Is the purpose to do chaturanga? That's not a good enough purpose for the general population. Most people will probably never learn how to do chaturanga. Now, if you're listening to this and you're thinking, well, we need to teach them, then you and I teach in different communities. If your people are all on their way to chaturanga and you need to clinic it once in a while, all the more power to you. That is not who I see on a weekly basis. And so in my mind, it all comes down to efficiency. What am I trying to achieve? And usually what I'm trying to achieve is working through the musculature in a way that is efficient and reasonably safe while also keeping up a certain pace. That's not to say that my classes move quickly. They're famously slow, but they're also famously sneaky hard. A friend of mine once came to class and asked if we were going to have a difficult class. And I said, my class is never difficult. And she said, that's not true. You're sneaky challenging. You're all sweet to begin with, but then you work it in and my legs are tired. So before I talk about changing what we're doing from the plank and the coming to the ground, let's briefly talk about cobra. So we tend to see people set up in plank, sometimes with these saggy shoulders, sometimes with spiking hips, etc., often with compressed wrists ultimately, and you see people taking a break and rolling out their wrists if you keep them there too long. Then they make it to the ground, and it's easier to come to the ground than it is to go back up with a slow pace, because we are stronger when we are going with gravity than against it. I think that intuitively makes sense to most of us. So people come to the ground, now they're lying on their belly. Now, what has happened if you are not practicing chaturanga into upward facing dog, which 98% of my students are not, your hands land further forward underneath your shoulders than is ideal for practicing back strength based cobras. When your hands land underneath your shoulders, you're slightly collapsed across the chest, and you're deeply tempted to simply push your hands into the ground and straighten your arms, thus manipulating your trunk into a flexibility-based backbend. Now, there's nothing wrong with enhancing flexibility if that's what you're choosing to do. But most of us aren't choosing to do that. Most of us are doing that because that's what we see the strong people doing, and so we do our best to approximate it. What we don't realize is how terrible our approximation really is. So myself included, and many teachers now teach what they call a back strength based approach to cobra, which is you back your hands up. So you back your hands up right underneath your low ribs, so your elbows are over your wrists. And I always say in class, there's nothing intuitive about this. No one backs their hands up and goes like, ah, yes, this is the natural position for me. So it's definitely a learned position. When you back your hands up, you shrug your shoulder heads back, And then you lift your spine off the ground using musculature lower down your spine. And this is why I like the cues: shrug your shoulder heads back, pick up your shoulders, neck, and then head, and lower back to the ground. Now repeat, pick up your shoulders, neck, and then head, upper arm bones track back, lower to the ground. As you keep going, pull your upper arm bones back as you draw your ribs forward. Now, the reason I'm saying all of these things, a couple of things. Aside from the inclination to push yourself into the tall, flexibility-based cobra, that's not particularly that useful for building the strength of back body and shoulder girdle that's going to counter all that desk work, because the musculature that we use in all that lifting of low cobras counters desk work. That's why it's worthwhile. Anyway, aside from that, people will hinge up and down at the weaker part of their spine, around where their rib cage and their low back meets, and to pick up their shoulders, neck, and head. Now, this range of movement can certainly strengthen your trapezius muscles. However, they are already a little fatigued and not put to the use that they were beautifully designed for because of that weak pitched forward shoulder position that we find at the desk. And our mind always uses what it already knows how to move to execute a movement. So that means that we have this tendency to exacerbate things that are strong, and sometimes strong for the wrong reasons, rather than tap into musculature that requires turning on. As teachers, we all know this. This is why we offer cues around engagement. Here's where you're going to push down into your feet. Feel like you're pulling this together or lifting this up or reaching this off of that. There's so many ways to say things. But as I told my trainees today, it's one thing to learn how to move bodies around in space. It's an entirely other thing to learn how to teach them where to engage, how to relax, what's worth paying attention to, all while keeping a calm atmosphere. And while we're on it, please never call it baby cobra. No grown adult wants to do the baby cobra version. They want to do the big king cobra. And it doesn't matter if you say the baby cobra is better, it's more strengthening, it does this and that. They will judge it unconsciously and sometimes very consciously. That's when you get them mashing their hands into the mat, forcing their spine up with straight arms and hunched shoulders. So what are our options? I like to think of a couple of things here. First of all, I think it's increasingly becoming aware to people that yoga sequences frequently strengthen the front of the body, the anterior chain, and stretch the back of the body, the posterior chain. So we really like to do things like core work and lunging and chair pose and all these things, balancing, all these things that strengthen musculature that is generally stronger than its counterparts on the back of our body. But then comes along basically all the seated postures, with the exceptions of twists, but all of those forward folds, not to mention that the term forward fold makes us think of moving forward in space from a seated position. But anything that you do reclined and bring your leg in towards you is a forward fold as well. That includes things like Supta Padangusthasana, the big toe bind reclined posture, or happy baby, or knees to chest, etc. So while we need more front body stretching with back bends, I'm not sure that the sun salutation or what you end up replacing it with is the best place to do that. I actually feel that the sun salutation still offers us an opportunity to strengthen people with some familiarity, but that we can evolve it to be of greater utility. So a couple of things that you can do. You can still start from standing, but like what I was taught as Chandra Namaskar, moon salutation, You could add a side bend to either side before a forward fold. You can still do your half lift. You could do chair pose and then work some half sun salutes in that look like that or something else. Then you could have people step back to plank. Now, it's very common for me to have people step back to plank and then lower three times, working as slowly as they can toward the ground. Because again, we're stronger when we work going with gravity than against gravity. So use that. Use that to come to the ground and slow it down and then come straight back up. Once you come down to the ground, you can do those repeated back strength based lifts in Cobra, but you can do a number of other things. One of my favorite iterations of that back strength Cobra is have people lift multiple times, then hold up, and then float the legs off the ground as well. And then you'll integrate more strength into the backs of the legs, including the hamstrings. Or you could do my favorite locust floats with your arms down by your sides. Inhale, head, arms, legs up, rotate ears, lower down, lift up to center on the inhalation, switch ears, lower down. Or you could reach your arms forward and lift up to Uttita Shalabhasana, extended locust. And with their arms up and their palms facing the ground, they can pull their elbows back toward their hips and then reach your arms forward. Then pull your elbows back, reach your arms forward. As you keep going and you draw your collarbone wide and you hug your muscles strongly in toward your center, know that your wrists are going to rotate toward the ground. Try to move your wrists back in line with your elbows so your fingers point up a little bit. This is all to say that you can work in quite a bit of back strength before you get people to come back to the ground and then move through table or plank to go back to downward facing dog. Now, once they come back to downward facing dog, if you've done a bunch of back strength work, it will feel so much different because downward facing dog, there's a number of things going on, but it is a back and back of leg stretch. Back to stretching that back body and strengthening the front body. To come back to the front of the mat, people often talk about, you know, a big step or jumping. And I think my cues around it are, for simplicity, look at your hands, bring your feet to your hands, and people tend to figure out how to get there. However, in my own practice, I frequently do this and I frequently teach it too. From downward facing dog, lift your hips dramatically high. Keep your hips lifting dramatically high the whole time as you walk with tiny steps toward your hands. Keep lifting your hips. And once you can get no closer to your hands, shift weight back into your feet. That's some of the mobility that you need if you wanted to do something like a handstand or a squeeze to a handstand, which I think I'm never going to do in this lifetime because I have too many books to read. But this is all to come back to the point that the mind and body get very good at what they do all the time, but we do not always know if what we are doing is the most efficient or illuminating approach. How can we be the mayonnaise on the grilled cheese sandwich? How can we wake ourselves up to other ways of doing things and be delicious or efficient in our approach to yoga asana so that our students are getting the most out of our classes and we are not being dogmatic simply for the comfort of being dogmatic? I could go on, and I'm not going to. I'm going to save it for Sun Salutations, the second installment, once you send me your questions, which you could do if you connect with me through the newsletter or social media. It's all www.intelligentedge.yoga or at intelligentedgeyoga. And you want to stay connected because little bit into early winter, dates are coming soon for a 4-day training on movement, the physiology of mobility, and how you can work mobility exercises into your yoga classes for strong, efficient classes that remain accessible. Until then, namaste for now, yogis.